We are back with another episode of Chawa for Leaders podcast. I am your host, none other, Cherish Fields, a master level social worker and child welfare leader. First, I want to say happy social work month to all of the social workers, but especially those who are practicing in the child welfare field. You are appreciated for all that you do, even if you don't hear often. What you do adds to our clients and the communities that we serve. Keep that passion lit and remember your why in all that you do. Do not let these systems drain out your passion, but use those obstacles that you face to advocate for change. We are change leaders and we are social workers. I'm happy that you all are joining me today. As I told you, I've had a great lineup of guests coming on the show. And I hope you've been able to tune in because it has been gem after gem dropped through these great conversations. So if you have not had an opportunity, make sure to go back to the podcast and catch up on those episodes because you will not be disappointed. I'm excited for our guest today, though, because she is a treat for real. She's a straight shooter and she's put content out there that we need to hear and that's not talked about openly. It's very relatable to the experiences that we may go through as social workers. So I had to have her on to share not only her story, but to also drop some jewels to help advance us as social workers and put in some respect on our name. Let me introduce you to Kenya Maldonado. She is a licensed master social worker and certified anger management facilitator in New York City. She is the owner of Onboarding Solutions, LLC, which supports social workers in understanding and owning their power through confidence building and talking points to advance their social work and leadership opportunities. Her motto is, there is money and power in social work. Kenya has been in the social work field for over 20 years, working her way from the front line to leadership. Her experience includes working with youth in foster care, running parenting and anger management groups with formerly incarcerated individuals, and mediating custody and visitation cases in the NYC court system. In the last 7 years, Kenya has shifted her focus to working in the homelessness and housing sector of social work. Kenya holds a BA in psychology from Syracuse University and is a graduate of Columbia University School of Social Work. She is an active member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated and a proud Afro-Latina who celebrates her Garifuna culture and Dominican roots. Kenya runs the onboarding business with her 6-year-old boss baby, Brandon. So I am so excited for you guys to hear this conversation, which will be coming up next. Welcome, Kenya, to the Child Welfare Leaders podcast, and might I add, happy social work month.
Happy social work month. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. So I'm so happy to have you join us representing the social workers out there in New York City.
Yes.
So, man, I love what I've seen on your social media pages. The content you put out is so relatable, and I'm thankful that our audience is going to be able to hear, you know, a little tidbits about this content that you're putting out from your experiences and hear from the true, you know, person behind the message, because what you are putting out there is so needed to hear, and it is so candid and real. And at the Child Welfare Leaders podcast, we like unapologetic conversation. So yes. I'm looking forward to the conversation that we have moving forward. So we can get right into it. I got to start off by asking you, what inspired your journey to become a social worker? Because as they say, ain't no money in social work. So like, where's the money?
That's what they say, but don't believe everything you hear.
That's
but
right.
First, I wanted to thank you so much for inviting me on your platform. I am happy to be here and to jump right in. So what inspired me to become a social worker? I would say it started really, really a long time ago when I was in high school, and there was a specific situation that happened, and it was while I was applying to colleges. And so I had a college counselor who I guess she felt that she was giving me a piece of advice and stated that, you know, I was aiming too high because one of the universities that I wanted to attend was Syracuse University. And so, you know, I grew up in Harlem, New York City, which is, you know, a very, you know, Black and Latino neighborhood. And so my counselor felt that I needed to probably attend a community college. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but perhaps that I should lower my standards and attend a two-year school, see how I did there, and then move on to, you know, the bigger goal. Wow. And unfortunately, I did not take that. Well, I would say fortunately, I did not take that advice because I just felt that, well, that's not really what I wanted to hear. You know, like you're supposed to be inspiring me to go on. Like Syracuse is a big deal. So I did go ahead. She did not give me a fee waiver because at the time there were fee waivers that you can get so that you don't have to pay this hefty application fee. And she said, no, you know, like, no. But I went on and I applied anyway. I think I asked my parents for the money. I applied and I was accepted to Syracuse University. And so really, I think the piece about self-advocacy and being able to advocate for myself was sort of my introduction into social work. At the time, I didn't know that that's what it was. It was just, you know, like I have to stand up for myself. But then when I sat and thought about it, I'm just kind of like, well, you know, if she's speaking to me like that, how many other people has she given the same message to? And how many other people have just taken that word of advice and said, you know what, maybe I will stay home or maybe I will just attend this two-year university. And so for me, that is where the journey of becoming a social worker, you know, like the light was lit up in me, and say that I have to do something. I didn't really know how that was going to come about because I wanted to go to school to be a broadcast journalist. And so that really wasn't social work. But, you know, like as I started to navigate and to see the world from a different place, because again, growing up in Harlem and then going to a predominantly white university, it opened my eyes to different things and just, you know, privilege and class and all types of things where I said, you know what, I really need to change the narrative. So in a nutshell, that's really how my journey into social work started.
And I love that because the self-advocacy and then also just like, hey, I'm gonna rise above what you think of me,
right?
Type of attitude, right? I love that. And then I love how you also kind of pointed out too of this, I'm gonna filter out what this person is saying. I'm still gonna go after this. And you said that you started off with, you know, wanting to do broadcast journalism. And look at where we at right now. Exactly. You got a platform on podcast. I'm a social worker. You a social worker.
Yes.
So we can make whatever happen with that social work degree, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So that's that versatility.
Yes.
I love it.
Yes.
So you are a master's level social worker?
Yes. I attended, you know, after I finished my 4 years at Syracuse, I took a little bit of time off, and then I decided to attend Columbia University School of Social Work. And I, you know, I got my master's in 2001. So I'm a little old, but I've been in the field. I've been in these social work streets for a couple of years now. And yeah, so I am a master level social worker. And, you know, I've kind of been, you know, I came in with one reason saying I wanted to help the youth because, you know, obviously I was inspired from my own experience. And through the years, that sort of has changed a little bit. But I haven't walked away from social work because every role I've held, even if I was the only social worker, there were so many skills, you know, that I gained that apply to my positions that I hold now. So, I mean, it's a journey. I love it. I mean, social workers, we wear so many different hats. And it does speak to that versatility. I mean, there's so many different skills that we bring to the table. So, yes, absolutely.
So we need to tell everybody, put some respect on our name.
Absolutely. That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, that's a great journey. And I'm so glad that you shared that because I do think that people could be strayed away because there is a lack of respect for social workers. And not that people out here just like disrespectful to us necessarily, but just more so like dumbing down the profession in the field.
Oh,
you don't want to be a social worker,
right?
Be a lawyer or a doctor because people are motivated by the provision of life, right? It's that, you know, the American dream.
Right. Right.
Social work isn't going to buy you the American dream, they say. It's not real.
Right.
You know, we know that's not real. And we'll get into that, you know, in this conversation. But absolutely. Yeah, so glad to that you went that route, because now I get to talk to you and we get to have you as a guest on the show.
Thank you. But just go ahead, sir.
Mm-hmm. And you are, like I said, I just put out there, I admire the content that I've been following because it's so relatable. And I want to be able to get into kind of some of the things that you post, because I think it's very real and authentic. And, you know, I don't meet a lot of social workers that are forthcoming and can, you know, be a straight shooter. And, yes. And I love that you are. And then you do it. I could tell you do it out of passion to inspire change.
Yes.
And so I'm like, oh, this is a rare breed. I need her on my show. I need her. Oh. So, yeah.
Thank you. But I just wanted to make a point that you made about, you know, the lawyers and the doctors. And I think that as social workers, we need to own our profession. We should not shy away from that we are social workers. I know that society has their definition of what they think social workers are, that we take, you know, kids away from their parents, yeah. You know, all these crazy things that people come up with. And I think that when people talk like that, that's our opportunity as social workers to educate and say, well, there are so many different levels to social work. We do so many different things yes. at a micro level and in the macro level. And I think that once we start to own that, you know, the same way that someone will come to the table and say, I am a doctor, I am a lawyer, I am an engineer. It's okay to say, I am a social worker. Our degrees are expensive. We go to big yeah. universities. I mean, yes. this is not a little thing. We have to learn so many skills, whether it's in the field, whether it's from the book, you know, it takes a lot to be a social worker.
It does.
And I think that we as social workers, you know, we need to learn that self-advocacy piece and educating people, because if we allow people to keep thinking that social workers are just doing these, you know, removing kids, well, that's what society is going to continue to identify us. So mm-hmm. it's our responsibility really to go out there and to educate and to, you know, change these misconceptions that people have about our field.
Girl, you better say that. And that's what you're here for. That yeah. is exactly why you are here in this interview, in this conversation, because I do think that that needs to be heard. And you are 100% right about owning it and being proud, right?
Yes.
That
yes.
we are social workers. And then there's another piece of you saying educate. Like, there's a lot of people that I have talked to that are younger and they're, you know, aspiring to figure out, like, okay, what should I do with my life? And, you know, I think that now in society, I see more people who, when they are seeking just kind of like their profession and their career goals, they are more inspired to do something that's meaningful.
Right.
I'm seeing a change in not so focused of what's going to give me this and give me that, but more so of what's going to impact people. Right.
Right.
So our younger generations, I think, are kind of taking those hits of, I don't want to just do something for the money.
Right.
I want to do something that's going to change and affect society in a positive way.
Absolutely.
Because frankly, there's too many societal things that are being exposed that, you know, I think that are inspiring people to step up and say, we yes. need to do something. And
yes.
so we're getting some young advocates, you yes. know, out here. And I don't think that social work is marketed enough
absolutely.
To show that that is a potential pathway
right.
To go that will give you marketable skills
mm-hmm.
you know, across all domains of life.
Right, right.
All fields of the profession in society, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, absolutely. So let's jump into, you know, some of the things that I've seen. So, you know, on your social media, you talk a little bit about the social work struggle. Can we talk a little bit about what inspired, you know, your points in the social work struggle? Maybe tell us, you know, some of the points that are in the social work struggle and then your experiences, you know, behind all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, I sat with this for a long time because, you know, I write notes to myself. I do a lot of journaling. I write my thoughts down. And so to put this particular post together about my struggle in social work, I struggled with it. Like, you know, I know that these are things that really happen, but how do I share this? And so I just sat and I said, you know what, let me just share it and see what happens. The struggle really comes from sitting at different tables, right? So I worked from the front line to leadership. And there have been some trends along the way. I am a woman of color. And so yep. I've sat at many different tables where my, I guess, counterparts don't necessarily look like me, but yep. they're making decisions for people that look like me. And so, you know, when we talk about right. these societal issues that are now coming up, like diversity, equity, and inclusion, some of these struggles lie around some of that. You know, coming in, I'm a fresh social worker, and I have these great ideas, and I share them with a supervisor, and then all of a sudden my idea gets implemented and I get no credit. And it's like, wait a minute, we talked about that in supervision. Yeah. What happened here? You know, like there's yep. no mention, like, you know, well, Kenya came up with this idea. It just comes to the table as if this is something I slept on, woke up, and I wanted to present it to the group. So that's one of the struggles. Imposter syndrome, right? Like sitting at the yep. table and feeling, am I good enough? Like you have this degree, but sometimes you still carry that self-doubt because you're looking around at other people. I mean, it doesn't have to be white. It's just people in general who have been in the field for a while and they speak so eloquently. And then sometimes I'm like, well, I grew up in the projects. Like, am I really good enough to be sitting at this table? Am I yep. supposed to be here? Like, how did this even happen? And so I think that the struggle was about my lack of confidence in myself. And then, you know, you learn. I've been in the field 20 years, so you learn. You learn how to navigate some of these systems. You learn how to build yourself, and you learn how to say, I'm good enough to be at these tables, right?
Yes.
You learn how to lead. Lead by example. Because sometimes, you know, I'm sitting in a space, and I'm very quiet, and I'm often overlooked because I'm quiet. And then it's like, no, you have to use your voice. The same way that I would advocate for myself, I have to advocate because I sit at the table with people who are making policies around, again, people who look like me. And so it's like, if I don't bring the frontline experience to this table, then no one is going to hear the person that I'm representing. So as a social worker, I become sort of the voice for the voiceless. So it's important for me to speak up. And I didn't really see that in the beginning. So that was a struggle for me. And so now that I do speak up, sometimes I'm seen as the resident troublemaker because it's like, oh, yeah. Lord, she's about to open her mouth. What is going to come out of her mouth?
And when you speak out, you know, I think, too, like that's a good point. And I want to hang on that just for a hot second because I, again, relatable, mm-hmm. very relatable with the fact that there's two identities here, right? The social worker and then the person who have lived experience, right? So you're seeing people make these decisions, policies, or, you know, recommendations on services for individuals that have a very similar experience as you. And you're like, oh, man, they don't get it.
Right.
In your brain, you're like, man, they don't get it. I need to be able to say something. But then there is that pause of, should I say something? Because a lot of people in my experience personally, just to piggyback off what you're saying, will tell you that's out of, you're stepping outside of your professional hat.
Mm.
Because your experience, that's too that's transference.
Right.
You have to come back, you're the professional. So it's almost like your experiences can't count when decisions are being made. Unless you're the client themselves.
Right.
So it's more respected coming from that way versus, well, I think there is power in my voice being heard at the table where decisions are being made, even more so because now I have the professional backing
yes.
to what the issue is at hand.
Right.
I'm not just coming at you with a testimony, mm-hmm. right? I'm coming at yes. you with academic, you know, right. Credentials,
right.
you know, and experience, you know, academically and professionally, but also just a life experience
right.
that should be acknowledged, absolutely. Right? And considered when you're talking about people who have similar experiences as you, because a lot, 9 times out of 10, many people in our situations who have, you know, decided to become a social worker were inspired by their experiences growing up.
Absolutely. Yes. And I also feel that, you know, as I sit in the table or I sit at the table, a lot of the policies and a lot of the work that is being done is just a lot of data and, oh, mm-hmm. evidence-based this, which is great. I mean, that stuff works. But get to know the person. You know, like, that's great. Yes. When we talk about the topics like homelessness, oh, okay, the data shows this and this and that. Okay, that's nice. But don't you want to know this person on a level where you can actually ask them a question and hear what they're saying? And so that's yes. where I feel like, you know, yes, it may be my personal experience because I worked on a front line, or maybe I was the customer or the client. However, those points are very important when we're sitting at the table. And that's why I've become more comfortable and confident in bringing them up. And it's how you bring it up, right? Because you bring uh-huh. the point of, now we have the academic backing. I'm not just going to interrupt the meeting and be like, yo, but that's totally wrong. It's how you present that, right? Because yes. I can still play with the data and say, okay, well, based off of this and my experience shows, and I can direct you to where you can get this information from. So it's how... some of it is a wordplay, some of it is optics, yep. right? Some of it is optics. Yep. It has to look a certain way. But when people like you and I are doing the real work, we know what happens on the front line, right? And then when you yep. sit at the table and you're listening, there's a disconnect. There's a disconnect as to how senior leadership may see something and what's really happening on the ground. When you're working right. on the trenches, you see things totally different. And some of it, yeah, it's personal experience, and we're not supposed to personalize the work, and we're not mm-hmm. supposed to have the transfer and counter transfer. But then I feel like some of that, you're not really showing up with your authentic self if you have to keep
That's right.
separating the two, because you have to feel this work. And to be a true social worker, to me, you have to feel the work. You have to, you know, these issues have to be so burning that you want to sit at the table and say, you know what? This looks good. However, I think you need to delve into this a little bit deeper, because what's happening on the front line, there's a disconnect. This is not what we're seeing here.
Yeah.
And so,
Facts.
Yes. And so I feel that, you know, we have all these theories in social work school, and I would be the first to say that I basically threw the books away. As soon as I graduated, I said, that's all nice. That's nice.
I love it.
Because you start to learn that what happens in the book is not necessarily how we are practicing in the field. I mean, and I would yeah. say that at least True. As being a New Yorker, I don't know if everyone else is playing by the books, but I feel like there are certain aspects of social work where I will be the first to say everything ain't clinical. Some things are common sense. Okay.
Yep.
And so, yes, I have this big fancy degree that hangs in my office, but I would say probably more of my personal experience drives me. And then I have that academic backing where I'm able to sit at the table and frame this in a way where my, you know, senior leadership understands where I'm coming from. So again, as social workers, is how we present ourselves, right? And how
yeah.
we bring the data, or how we bring the information to the table. And yes, I mean, absolutely, some of this is personal. And I feel like this is-
and I want you to say that again. Like, I think that you gotta feel social work, man. That is a quotable thing. We gotta keep that, because that is 100% real, and you don't hear people say that. You gotta feel, and you know, honestly too, everything isn't clinical and everything isn't need to be analyzed. Exactly. It's just the reality of people's lives that you need to sit with it for
Absolutely.
A second. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And hear from them and what they need, right? And help them navigate, you know, the systems that we work in to get what they need. But everything isn't this analytical, assessed, and you know, clinical framework. Some
yes.
stuff is just, it is what it yes. is. And now we got to figure out how to help that client or that family or, you know, whatever. You see what I'm mm-hmm. saying? Whoever we're supposed to be helping. But that is so, so real. You got to feel this.
Yes.
Work. And if you don't, look, and this is how I feel. If you can't feel it, then you might be in the wrong profession if you can't handle
yes,
it.
Yes, I would say that, you know, I've had to check myself a couple of times, because sometimes I've been in spaces where you do become desensitized. You know, I worked in an environment where death was a common occurrence, and I had to really, mm-hmm. you have to be self-aware in this field, because I got to the
yes.
point where I had so many clients having overdoses and just all types of things happening. And I had to sit with myself and say, you know what, you don't want to become so desensitized that when someone that's personally, you know, close to you dies, you're not going to feel anything, right? And so as social
That's
workers,
right.
we need to be self-aware too. We need to know our limits. You know, we can feel the work, but we also burn out really easy because we are that
yeah.
passionate. So I would always say, you know, self-care, you know, we can do this
yes.
in a moderation, and we can't help anybody if we're pouring from an empty cup. Like, there's no such thing, right? You have to be
yeah.
able to say, I can... you know, take care of everyone else's need, but sometimes we have to put ourselves first. And I wanted to touch on one point that we talked about previously, which is our clients tell us what they need, right? These systems, we teach them how to navigate, but if we really listen, you know, if a client is coming to you for food, they didn't ask to be assessed. They're not asking you to open a DSM-4 and try to find out what their diagnosis is. They're simply asking you for food. That's their immediate need. Please address it, you know? So some of it is that simple. It really is.
No, that's, and that's real. And I love too how you said, you know, even though you gotta, this is a practice that we have to feel, and you know, you're not the, New York is not the only place. I could tell you here in Michigan that for me and my practice, everything isn't in the book. I keep books because I like the knowledge, but at the same time, I love the comparisons of what the book says and what I'm actually practicing, and realizing that the two really is hard to translate because systems and actions have to move faster than what the theory can play
out.
You see what I'm saying? And so I love that you say, you know, having awareness, self-care. Another thing I'm gonna throw in there too is when you are doing work, like you said, you've seen people pass away, you've seen, you know, people overdose, like very tragic stuff, because that can be very traumatic. Secondary trauma, right, is very real. Burnout is very real. What is your thoughts? Because this is like something that we're talking about more in our community of color, is therapy and mental health. As a social worker, do you feel like you would benefit, or it benefits social workers to have their own therapy?
Absolutely. Yes, I do. I feel that we see so much and we have to sort of process these feelings quickly, right? We're in the space, and especially as someone who's in a leadership role, right? I ran a shelter where, you know, not only do I have to process really quickly that one of my residents passed away, now I have to go deal with my team, a team of about 40 people who all are processing this in different ways, right? Because some had a relationship with the client, some may have been around the client, you know, so there are people that are also dealing with this as you're going through it, right? And so where do you unload? You know, I used to go home and dump to my, you know, my fiance and just kind of say, this is what's happening. And he would look at me like, I don't know what to tell you.
Right.
And so that's not really the safe space, because then you are bringing that home. You're dumping on someone else who's just kind of like also starting to personalize it, because they're looking at you breaking down. They're looking at how this is all affecting you. And so you have to have your own safe space. And it's cool to go out with the girlfriends and have brunch and all that. That's not it. You need a space where you can sit and unpack these feelings and you can process it and you can have a different way to look at it, because, you know, getting advice from someone who is neutral, or just someone that's neutral that's helping you walk through the process, does not compare to your girlfriend telling you, oh girl, that ain't nothing, you know, like you'll be fine. Like, that's not what you need. Sometimes you need to really be able to dig deeper and to understand why certain cases affect you a certain way. Like, what is it about this situation that's hitting me, you know, so hard? Yes, we absolutely should have that safe space to have a therapist to work through our own, because, you know, as social workers, we have the work sort of baggage, but we are humans too. We have our own things that we, you know, childhood trauma and all these things that we have to deal with. And how do you separate the two when you come into the workspace? Like, that transference may come into play because this particular client reminds you of an uncle or something. Like, we have to deal with those things. So absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
And not only that, I think there is benefits of having, you know, a social worker on your speed dial or on your favorites, because of the fact that social workers a lot of times are balanced in so many different roles. So let's just be honest, sometimes you got that 9-to-5, but you got that side too, you know, hustle that you are doing to help put food on the table at times, you know, or just earn some extra to do what you might want to do, you know, save up or whatever. But a lot of times social workers are wearing a number of hats. Include being mothers and fathers and husbands and wives, you know, the partners, friends, you know, taking care, caregivers, you know, just so many things going on in our own personal lives, and the sacrifices that we make for the work, because social work, if we're real, are non-traditional hours.
Yeah,
we are not banker's hours where we're coming in at, you know, 8 a.m. and being able to leave at 4 or 5 o'clock.
Oh no.
You know, we are meeting with clients sometimes, you know, at 8 o'clock p.m. or if there's a crisis, we might be at the hospital with that client.
Yes.
So there's just so many different things. Or weekends. We ain't getting guaranteed weekends off. Yes. You know, so I think that there's a benefit also to, you know, for all of us to definitely look into getting a therapist of your own, you know, to process, like you said, those things. And I just want to put that out there too, because it's large. I have one.
Right.
You know, it's largely beneficial and it keeps you healthy.
Yes.
You know, and it's preventative for the burnout.
Yes.
The stress that, you know, that's there. So you can kind of stay in that good mood to be able, like you said, I'm not pouring from an empty cup.
Right.
Right. Because I'm emptying the stuff, the contents that don't need to be sitting there, so that I can, you know, receive again, you know, whatever someone, you know, has to put on me.
Yes.
So I love that. Let's talk a little bit too about, you said underpaid, and then I definitely want to talk about this non-social workers running social work agencies and organizations, your experience with that as well.
Oh, yes, yes. So I would say that, the agency I work for now is run by, it's the largest social service agency, and it's actually run by a lawyer. And there have been several spaces, and there are several nonprofits that I have worked for that either the senior leadership, which is the CEO, maybe an MBA, so they have a business degree, or they're a lawyer. And so, you know, that is a hard pill to swallow, right? Because we go to these universities again, we have these degrees, we have these skills where we're at the front line, we understand what's happening, and then somewhere around mid-management, we start to get cut out. We start to get cut out because... oh, we don't have the fundraising skills, because, you know, once you get to the top, it's about keeping an organization afloat financially. And so oftentimes social workers are not even, I mean, I've seen jobs recently where they ask for an engineering degree to run a social service agency. And I'm like, I get housing development part. Okay, so I get where urban planning and maybe engineering, but like, well, they cut the social worker out completely from this. And I just had to like really sit on this and think about it. But yes, I have worked in several spaces where, like I said, you know, the senior management is not a social worker. And so the way the policies come down are very driven by whatever monies they may be getting from private foundations or from private, you know, funders that have their own, you know, deliverables or whatever have you that they want to see. And so, you know, as I move into a leadership role and I start to see who sits at the table, of course, I start to analyze, okay, what's the skill that they have that I don't? And it usually really comes down to that financial skill. So I have purposely, you know, kind of delved into budgets and learning grant writing and all that good stuff, because we do have those skills as social workers.
Yeah.
We, you know, sometimes we have to sit and do a budget with our clients, and we feel like, oh, that's not really budgeting, but it is. The only thing that is, as you work in a larger organization, the budget is more money. So you do know the basics of, I mean, we all have budgets in our everyday life to pay bills, you know, so, you know, you get your check in your bank account, you have to do check and balances. So we have those skills. And I think that, you know, this is kind of going off on a tangent, but as social workers, we need to own these things. We have to be put ourselves where we're more marketable. I think sometimes because we're so focused on the client facing skills that we have, we don't necessarily look at the administration skills that we also possess, right? Because communication is one of the biggest ones. I mean, any job posting you look at, they want you to be an effective, you know, communicator, right?
Yes.
I would say that social workers by nature, that is the basis of what we do. We have to negotiate.
That's right.
We have to be able to communicate. We do a lot of public speaking. We advocate. Those are all skills that we can use to kind of work ourselves into these positions that we think we're not qualified for. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah. And, you know, it's no shade to people who are in those positions that don't have a social work degree. But I think what we want to say is, you know, in a part of putting some respect on our name as social workers is recognizing that in the social service field, we want to see more people that have our degrees in those positions, you know, and the relatability of when I saw your post on that, I was just like, oh man, preach girl, because for years I've looked at the child welfare system in the Department of Health and Human Services in a number of states, and I have not seen for years any leader picked that has a social work degree. And I'm like, why not? Why not? Why not a deputy director or, you know, anyone who has a social work degree, we should be picking them more.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I just would like to see that, yes, you know, on a more frequent. It doesn't mean, hey, this other person who has an MBA or engineering degree or a law degree, because a lot of times you see them, you know, those, yes, who have law degrees that are, mm-hmm, in those positions.
Right.
It's not to discount them, but I do think that we should, because of the way the system works, even with, you know, Department of Health and Human Services, specifically in those child, you know, I would say, because this is a Child Welfare Leaders podcast, mm-hmm, Children's Services, having more of a social work leader, you know, in those positions, because you're talking about case management, direct care services, the case, you know, not only case management, but also the therapeutic components, right? Yes. The clinical services and things, yes, like that. Right. And that's hard to be a leader at the top and funnel that down to people when you don't have those skills.
Right.
You want, mm-hmm, somebody who's been on those front lines and kind of work their way up to then bring it down.
Absolutely. I agree.
And it can work together.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, I agree.
So absolutely.
I agree. And just to go back to your other point about the underpaid, because I know that that's one of the struggles that I put up in there. And so, you know, graduating out of graduate school, I mean, 2001, my first job, I was paid at $35,000. And to me, I already knew that I was being underpaid. I'm like, I have a whole master's degree. How is this possible? But I was, mm-hmm, just so happy and eager. Oh, I have a director position. Like, this is a big thing. And it wasn't until then when I started to, like I said, look at budgets and start to, mm-hmm, open things and look at, oh, okay, the person before me was paid a little bit more. And they didn't, you know, I don't know if they negotiated. I don't know what it was. But I think at that point for me, you know, I just really felt that I have to advocate for myself a little bit differently, right?
Yep.
Because my degree was not cheap. I paid about, right, $750 a credit. You know, yep, like, that's a lot of money, right? And to come, yep, out and make, looking back now and saying, coming out to make 35, I think my student loans was more than that. You know, yep, like, yep, how is that possible? And so as you start to navigate, I feel, again, going back to these skills and how we market ourselves, you know, if a job posting is usually, and this is me speaking as a hiring manager in the field, yep, sometimes job postings may say 40 to 50,000. And so you want to push to the higher sort of range of that because you know that you have skills on there. If you look at the job descriptions, they may have skills or they may not have skills on the job posting that you have. And so you need, yep, to kind of stand on that and say, okay, well, your job posting doesn't have that. I bring this certification. I bring this. I bring that. And let's not forget that negotiation is not only about the salary that you're getting. It's also about, can you get the organization to maybe pay for your clinical hours if you're trying, yep, to get, you know, or are they going to provide this for you? You know, if you're looking to, if you have continuing education credits you have to complete, is the organization going to pay for this? So there are other ways to negotiate and to be marketable. And sometimes we are like, oh, the money. Look at the benefits. I mean, like, yep, look at the whole picture. Because 40,000 may actually be 60,000 if you calculate all of these other things. And sometimes we don't look at it from that lens. But again, I mean, we really have to be able to own our skills and not just jump at the first offer or the first opportunity. And that's something I had to learn along the way. I will say it's possible for social work, especially if you're into leadership and administration. Social workers can make six figures. I mean, that's a conversation. Like, with social work, sometimes we don't want to talk about the money, right? Like, it's no, yeah, taboo. We don't want to talk about money. It's impossible. Like, nobody says, well, how much do you make? You just kind of have sort of like, oh, all right, they're mid-management, so they're making this. You can absolutely make six figures if you're running an organization, if you're a director. I think even as an assistant director, sometimes you can work your way into that. Yep. And so underpaid social workers, we're still underpaid, but I feel that we have to be able to market ourselves. We have to be confident in the degree and the skill sets that we bring to the table. And I think that as we start to push back, people will start to respect us, right? Even from, yep, like workload. And I'm not saying push back in a sense where no, there are ways that our degrees have helped us communicate and advocate for ourselves where we don't seem standoffish. We know how to work data and evidence into things to show I can't be as productive when I'm carrying a caseload of 30 versus when I'm carrying a caseload of 20. So yeah. Those are all points.
And I think there's some shame in that, mm-hmm. and some guilt that I think that we all carry sometimes, because we know as a social worker, we do that for our clients. But I think when you talk about yourself, that's that, you know, social workers are a lot of times selfless, right? So when you kind of have to turn it around and use those skills for yourself, you feel a little guilty, right?
Yes.
Like, I just want to help people. And you don't want people, like the optics, to look like you're only helping people for the money or that benefit, right? But I think what you're saying is real. Is as social work, owning our skill sets, owning our abilities and our knowledge, and taking that and utilizing that to leverage for better lifestyles, to take care of ourselves, right? Because self-care costs money sometimes, right?
Oh, yes, it does. Like,
taking care of your family costs money, and there's no shame in that, because how can you do what you love if you're not taking good care of yourself?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So I love
it. I preach self-care in everything now. I mean, it took me a while, you know, as a new social worker coming into the field. I always say, you're so eager, you're ready to jump in. And management sees that, right? That's why they hire us, because they know, oh, this person is eager. They're going to work long hours. They're going to get this done. Some of that sometimes trickles from the top in terms of poor management, you know, because it's like, all right, well, we're just going to give you a caseload of this and pay you at the bottom. And so to go back to my point, as a hiring manager, when I say you want to aim to the higher ends of the salary, is because usually in the budget, and because I play with budgets, they have probably $10,000 to $15,000 more allocated to that position. And so, yes, of course, an organization is going to want you to take the entry pay, because it'll save them money on their budget that they can allocate to other salaries or other, you know, parts of the program. But it's important for us to feel confident when we're sitting at the table and knowing our worth and saying, you know, I deserve a little bit more because I bring X, Y, and Z skills. And I really do think that we need to start sort of standing on that, because it just goes back to our whole conversation about being confident. You know, I'm sure that if someone has a law degree, they're very confident in saying, I went to Yale and I deserve X amount of dollars.
Yeah.
And we don't have that same energy as people in other fields. And I get it. I mean, it's a totally different field, but we should be as proud as people in other professions, because we really do impact change. We really do make a difference. I feel like every profession, really, the basis of it requires social work skills. You know, so like, why shouldn't we be out there saying we deserve a little bit more? You know, and if you have those success stories where you've been able to turn something around, where you had a client where they were disengaged, but you got them to the point where they're now engaged and they're, you know, performing, like, those are things that you should be talking about in these interviews, because really organizations want to see, what do you bring to me and how can you help me grow? So I think the interviewing and marketing yourself and being underpaid, like, all of that stuff is a two-way street. You have to interview your or the organization also to see what can they offer you. It's not just, oh, I need this job really bad. So we need to start kind of changing the lens about how we, like, oh, I need them. No, they also need you.
Need you. That's right. That's right. Because that's kind of goes into that next piece I really want to touch on before we close out, but the organizational trauma and picking your sanity over bureaucracy. So when you get into these organizations, there's things like being underpaid, right? Being undervalued, and things that you experience that cause trauma. And how do you, like you said, how do you pick your sanity over bureaucracy? And a part of that, I'm pretty sure you're going to talk about, is advocacy, right? So your self-advocacy. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yes. So organizational trauma. I mean, I know I talk about this all the time, and this is something that's really personal to me, and it's almost the basis of why I started the onboarding business. And so I can give a story about this just to put it into context. And, you know, as a woman of color, again, I feel like when we come into positions, or at least for myself, I would speak for myself, is that I have to bring the whole bathroom, the tub, the sink. Like, I have to work harder to be acknowledged or to be seen. And so when you sit at the table and you see certain things and you're like, all right, I can do this, and you start to do it. And then let me just back. I had a position where the organization just really was giving up on the program. They felt that this program wasn't even worth the effort anymore. But here comes Kenya. No, I think I can help you save this program. I come in, they give me the opportunity. They laughed. And then they said, do you really want to do this? And I said, absolutely. And they're like, well, how are you going to fix this? And I'll say, I can show you better than I can tell you. I did absolutely that. Saved the organization a lot of money. I mean, turned the program around, staff morale, all types of things.
Get it, girl.
Yeah, it took a lot of work. And I want to add, I had just had my son. My son was 2 months old. I don't know what type of adrenaline I had going, but I definitely was working.
You a superwoman.
Yes, I was. Turned this program around. A position is opening up now, which is like an assistant vice president position. And I'm all hyped up about it. I know that's mine. I already claimed it. That's my title. It's for me. And get overlooked. Do you understand the amount of resentment? Because I just killed myself. Like, I gave up everything. Yes, you guys are paying me great money. This is wonderful. But I killed myself only to be overlooked. And so when we talk about organizational trauma, I mean, these are the things that can happen because as social workers, we're so passionate. We're all about giving our all. We're all about, I'll skip lunch to make sure that my notes are caught up, you know, because we're passionate about the work we do.
And like you said, the thanks you get a lot of times in social work is more
work. Right.
And it's like, no.
You could do that. So let's do this. And you're going to train this person too. Yeah. And so not to go too far off on a tangent, I think that, you know, the way that that impacted me, I had resentment. I walked around for a while, like just making stories in my head about like, you know, I'm not good enough, but then this organization kind of, you know, like they played me like, this is not cool. And, you know, I sat on that for like months. I just was so upset. I felt like when I walked into the workspace, I just wasn't myself anymore. It really wasn't helpful. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I was helping anybody anymore. I hit the point where it's just like, just leave this alone. It's time to go on. All of that to say is that I set my limits to this position in this organization, which is a very big organization. And I left. I kind of said, I have to pick my sanity over this because, you know, again, the deaths and all types of things happening. So I stepped back from that. I had no plan, resigned. And within a couple of weeks, I had a call. I had applied for different positions. So within a couple of weeks, I was called in for an interview and I landed that position. And all of that is that now I oversee the entire portfolio in New York City, where I had my sort of limits on this small program in this organization, and I had resentment, and I carried this organization like trauma and everything. Like, I'm so upset. But all of that to say is how this ties back to, you know, being a leader and just being a social worker is that sometimes we're so hard on ourselves and we have this tunnel vision about like, this is as far as I can go. And the point was that I had built a name for myself that my name had already entered spaces that I didn't even walk into yet. And that's how I was able to land this next opportunity that I'm in. And like I said, it went from me thinking I can run this really small portfolio to now overseeing the whole citywide portfolio. So rejection is part of the process. I think that what I'm saying all of this is that sometimes we can't personalize the work. We have to take, I think my post today was about like, you know, take those what the F moments and use those as strengths and character building exercises. Sometimes when we're in the moment, we don't see it, but this is all part of the journey. These things make you strong. They build character. Yep. You know, I am still grateful for that organization, even though they overlooked me, because they really helped me, you know, make a name for myself. They helped me build the person that I am today, to be respected as leader, to be able to be confident when I walk into a space. And, you know, I joke a lot about like, build yourself until your name becomes your resume. And
that's right.
You know, not only is my name sort of my resume in small spaces, I'm not saying the whole social work, but I'm proud when I sit at the table to say I am a social worker. Like, I am, like, make sure you acknowledge that I'm a social worker, because I sit at the table with people that have degrees in policies and all of these things. And it's like, I'm good enough. As a social worker, I am good enough. So to tie it back to your question about like the organizational trauma, we are good enough. We are good enough, and we have to own that. You know, we have to walk into the space with confidence and just, you know, claim your space. Claim your space as a social worker. It's okay. Like, we rock.
That's right. And if you got to pick your sanity over bureaucracy, it's okay to do that. It's nothing wrong with that. And that doesn't mean that you didn't make change. Because like in your experience, you said you, you know, busted your butt for this program to still be alive. That's still your, that's your legacy. Right. You built that. Right. And though you didn't get the credit that you deserved, you said, hey, that's okay. I'm going to protect my sanity in this situation and I'm going to walk away. Right. And that's okay sometimes, because we can be in an organization and stay in a place that's re-traumatizing us consistently by overlooking us, making us feel less impactful, invaluable, and all these things. And it's going to burn us out quicker. Right. And then we're going to be no help in that moment. But when you can stand tall and say, no, my, I have more value to bring to this. I am still worth it. My skills and abilities are not at loss. And that ownership of your, you know, being a social worker and taking your talent somewhere else, you ended up getting something. Your gifts made room.
Oh,
for
absolutely.
You see what I'm saying? So that was a blessing sometimes when you see those, that rejection, or if you see these walls, bureaucratic walls being put up, you know, from you being able to advance. Sometimes you got to step back and, you know, reflect. Mm-hmm. Right. And then choose your sanity.
Yes.
Over all of that.
Sanity over everything. Sanity. And I think you said a key word, which is value. Like values.
Yes.
You know, that word constantly is something that I journal about. My values. Like when you get to the point when you're losing your values in the space, you know that space is no longer for you, right? Because we have the code of ethics and all these things. And if you're working in spaces where, okay, my value as a human and my value as a social worker, like there's a disconnect there, sometimes we do have to say, you know what, I need to make a choice. And it's all about self-awareness and being confident enough to know that your skills are valuable. So I feel like as social workers, we can't really be out of work. Like there's so many spaces for us. It's how we market ourselves.
Yes. And you've been kind of teaching us a little bit about how we should market ourselves as social workers already, but give us just a couple more about how we can position ourselves as social workers to, you know, get the jobs that we really want, you know, to have.
Right. So I think that one of the things that I've learned just along the way is, you know, having confidence. I talk about that all the time. But these situations that we are put in, like when our supervisor is passing on tedious tasks that we're like, oh brother, why are they giving me this? That's your opportunity to build a name for yourself. Those tedious meetings that your supervisor is kind of like, I don't want to go to. Yes, go in there and work the room. Make sure before you leave, everyone knows who you are and what department you work for. So networking. You know, doing like trainings. Like I feel like you get into trainings, you meet people. So not only are you networking in there, you're coming with an added skill. So you're able to come back and implement that, even if it's in your everyday routine, if it's running a group at your organization, if it's coming back and do like a, you know, train the trainer type of thing where you're coming back to talk to your peers and say, I took this wonderful training. We should all learn the skill. And I think that, I mean, this is marketable in a sense where you can be a leader, even as a case manager or, you know, as a case A coordinator. You don't necessarily need to be in leadership to be a leader. You can lead from your very, you know, seat. It's how you come in and you lead by example. And that's one thing that when I, you know, was supervising at a foster care program, I would always say, like, you can be a leader. You don't have to speak to me all the time. You can actually speak up in the meeting and impact change. It doesn't need to come through me. And that's how I empowered a lot of my, you know, team, and saying that you have to have a sense of ownership. So claim your place at the table. When you have a good idea, don't think that, oh, well, my supervisor is going to turn it down. Speak on it. Speak on it. Own it. You know, execute, do what you need to do so that people could start knowing you and respecting you at the table. So those are all ways that you can become marketable. But I think the number one thing, and I think the social media makes it easy for us, is the marketing. I mean, is the networking piece. The networking piece has become so easy. LinkedIn, you know, we have Instagram. I didn't have these things when I was in school. I had to actually, like, you know, get the energy up to actually go give someone a handshake in the space to say, hi, I am. And they would look at me like, and you are? Like, what do you want?
Yeah.
Social media has really made it a space where we can just drop into somebody's DM, or we can go on LinkedIn and look at someone's whole history and just kind of drop a question and communicate on a level that is less intimidating, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that you could definitely utilize those things to advantage. And I want to add something I've seen where you said making yourself more marketable in terms of certifications,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Adding to your specialization.
Yes. So I had a job with where I worked with Parole a couple of years ago, and they wanted me to teach an anger management class. No one had any idea. It was just like, buy a book and like just figure it out. And I did research, and I actually was able to find this program that's based out in California. It's Anderson & Anderson. So they had a whole like certification process. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do this. I did it. The organization did end up paying for me to complete this course. But I say all of that to say that not only did I complete it for this specific position, what I was able to do with that certification is start my own anger management group where I actually had it outside of the organization that I worked for. And I actually have an anger management manual that I'm working on that's launching next week. So all of, I'm working on a couple of other things, but that's one that, you know, because I stepped out and I did a certification, it not only helped me with that one position, but it's helped me with, you know, several other positions that I've held. And, you know, you can make it a skill that pays you. Yeah.
And that's in demand because we need, you know, more skilled people who understand anger and where it comes from and being able to help people work through that.
Yes.
Right. So absolutely, especially in these times, because there's a lot of situations going on that are making a lot of people angry, which I do not blame them. But yeah, to be able to work through that, I mean, you've set yourself up and positioned yourself very well.
Thank you.
You know, for the times as well. So people should, you know, kind of look at what is our climate telling us in society that's necessary, and being able to look at your skill sets and your passions to say, oh, I could do that. And then being able to find things that align with that mission, mm-hmm. right?
And speaking to that, I would say that I feel like as a social worker, one of the things that I learned is every position I had, maybe because I'm so critical and I overanalyze everything, I always felt there was a gap. Oh, there's a gap here. You know, what can I do to fill that gap? There's money in those gaps. Those are skills mm-hmm. where you're able to package something and say, okay, you know what? Like I said, they didn't have the anger management program. I was able to package that for the program, but then I packaged that. And how can I use this outside of my workspace? So there are skills that we have. There are voids in the system where we can sort of market ourselves and make that a product that will help others. It can be a nonprofit organization. It can be, you know, a marketable package that you put together. But the whole point is that we do a lot of analyzing and just, you know, dissecting things and saying, well, think about all the things we don't like in our current positions and say, this is what will make it better. But guess what?
You can
be the creative behind that. This would make it better. Create that product. That's marketing yourself as well.
Yes, that's absolutely good. Girl, you speaking truth out here. These are facts. I hope people taking notes because this is real. Yeah. All right, man, we're getting it to the end of our time, but I would love for you to tell us about your business, because I know the first thing is you are a social worker, but you also are a business owner. So tell us a little bit about your business.
Sure. So real quick, onboarding started from a place of frustration and passion. And it really comes down to, as a social worker, interviewing people that were coming out from grad school and noticing that, you know, sometimes we're very proud to have a master's degree, but our resumes don't speak to that. Our talking points during interviews don't really speak to that. And so one of the things that for me was, okay, people have career centers at their school. Are they utilizing it or not utilizing it? There's a void here. So again, talking about that void. And so I felt that as someone that's been in the field a while, what can I do to fill this void? How can I help, you know, new social workers that are coming into the field learn how to navigate? Give them the key pointers that they need to land positions in the field. So part of what onboarding does is we do resume reviews and edit. We help with cover letters. We help with talking points, how to position yourself and build confidence. So when you're sitting at the table, you can, you know, definitely assert your skills. And we help with people that are in the field, let's say you're a case manager and you're really trying to navigate, we have a guide that can help you with like some key pointers. But it's really about developing social workers and being confident in owning our field. Because I said, you know, whether it's a master's that you have or a bachelor's degree in social work, we are social workers. We need to network and stick together. But the biggest component of onboarding really is about, you know, again, I know I say this a lot, as a woman of color, I didn't necessarily have a mentor in the field. And so I feel that this is an opportunity for me to help social workers advance themselves. Definitely people of color who feel that I can make it to mid-management, but I cannot pass that. What do I need? We are developing a leadership workshop to really help, you know, people, again, own their skills, build confidence, and feel you know, empowered enough to say, you know what, even though I'm a social worker, I can still be a leader. So really, onboarding combines all of that to build social workers. I think that, you know, even if we change one social worker at a time, that's a big deal.
That is. And I love it. And I've utilized the resume services that she has. And it's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So give us your handles. How can people find you, reach out to you, connect with
you? Sure. So I can be found on Instagram at onboardingstaff. Our website is www.onboardingstaff.com. I can also be found on LinkedIn, and the business page is Onboarding Solutions, and my personal LinkedIn page is Kenya Maldonado, LMSW. Kenya spelled K-E-N-I-A, last name M-A-L-D-O-N-A-D-O. Thanks.
Awesome. I love it. Yeah, I'm definitely highly recommend. I'm going to have all that too also in our episode description so people can, you know, quickly reference if you didn't catch that. Or you could press rewind as well, but I'll make sure that it's definitely available so that people can look you up with you, because I think you are definitely worthwhile
to
connect with, girl.
Oh, thank you.
It has been a pleasure to have you on. You are such a like-minded social worker. So to come across you in terms of connection has been truly my privilege and my honor, truly.
I'm humbled. I'm so humbled. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Hey, it's Social Work Month. I got to give you appreciation where it's due, you know, and you're doing it out here. And I appreciate someone who is as passionate about this work as I am. So we got to stick together, as you said.
Yes, yes.
All right. And last words, I need you to give us like two major leadership change tips.
Leadership change is, lead by example. I think that, you know, just leading by example, you know, not only did I sort of give directives to my team, but I'm one of those leaders that I get dirty. I get in the trenches because I'm not going to ask you to do something I'm not willing to do. So we do it together. That's real. Show up as a united front, we're more powerful. And in that same vein, I would say I'm as strong as my team. As a leader, I am as strong as my team, because it's my duty to figure out what the people on my team, what their individual strengths are, and also as a group, what are your strengths? Because if we can do the work, you know, it's leadership is selfless. I always say that. It's not about me. Yes. It's about how do we meet the needs of the client, right? And so if we're able to make or to satisfy our client's need, then the staff feels empowered, senior leadership is happy, and then that's a reflection on me as a leader. So I take it away from me. It's really about the client, right? It's about meeting those needs and making sure that the client's needs are met is the most important things about the leader. But it's your leadership really is about how you're able to drive your team to meet those goals. And so I would say that that is one of my leadership, you know, traits. And then transparency. I'm a human. You know, I have a life outside of social work. And when I show up as myself, my team is able to appreciate me more. If I don't know something, I will tell them, you know what, I don't really know all of it, but let me dig into this a little bit deeper. And when I get the answer, I will let you know. So I think it's about being honest and being able to communicate, being able to lead by example, and just being yourself.
I love that. And that's what this podcast is about too, is leading where you are. So I'm going to recommend two books. One for those who are listening, 360 Leadership by John C. Maxwell. That was one of the things that inspired this podcast, to talk about lead change where you are, because no matter what position that you're in, whether you direct frontline worker or you're at the top, we are leading no matter what, because we're showing up with who we are, our passions, our skills, our abilities, and there's value in that. And we can do amazing things to influence change and lead change, and no matter what the position.
That's right.
The second book I want to recommend to those listening is Lead When You're Not in Charge by Clay Scroggins. I've read that book like twice already, might go for a third. One, it's entertaining. Two, he be saying real facts. It really does change the way you look at stuff in terms when you can lead, even though you're not in charge. This is not about the power that you get in the position. It's about your influence right there.
Right.
Right. And how that can actually even cause more change to happen for those that are the leaders, you know, at the top. You know, because your influence is big, and he gives a good example about Chick-fil-A. So I won't spoil it a little bit, but very, very good books available on Audible, Amazon, wherever you get your books. But we're all about personal development here and being able to make system change and having real authentic conversations like we've had here. Again, Kim, thank you so much for being my guest. I so appreciate you. And I look forward to again being able to connect and maybe even have you on here.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I am humbled. I love this. I love the work that you're doing. Keep going. I love it.
Will do. All right, y'all take care. All right.
Man, I hope you guys enjoyed that episode as much as I did. Having this great conversation with Kenya, all these jewels, she definitely came through and dropped. I'm just so blessed to come across people who have like-minded minds, but also just that passion about what they do and who they are. And she is one of them. You know, there's so much going on in society, so much negativity, so many things that make us angry and disappointed, and sometimes just feeling defeated, right? Because when you serve people, there will be disappointments, and there's a lot of obstacles in the way from you being able to affect change the way you want to. But when you could take all of that energy and you turn it into this burning passion that essentially makes changes in not just people's lives, but in the profession and in your field, it just says something, right? So, and that's what I'm hoping that you guys got from this as well, is, you know, don't let these outside forces and what's going on in society diminish your passion, but let it inflame it more. Let it be something where people see your light, and come to it, and you have and offer solutions, because where there are voids, where there are gaps, we can fill them. And I hope that's what you have learned and are learning from this podcast, because we need more people who are ready to stand up against the status quo. I do want to say there was a part in the conversation and we talked about more social workers in leadership. And I do want to acknowledge that I know in the state of Michigan recently, there was actually a change in who the director is, as a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of leadership transitions, and we do have a leader over child services agency who is a social worker and has been practicing in the social work field for quite some time. So we do see it. We just want to see more of it, because we do think that there's benefits to seeing people who have been on the front line and seeing them in leadership, as long as they haven't forgotten what it takes to be at the bottom, or at least, you know, now getting the feedback from the frontline people and incorporating it into how to improve, you know, systems and organization and flow of services to make sure that it really gets to our clients. So kudos to that. But if you are someone who is aspiring to be in leadership, keep moving, take Kenya's advice, go follow her. And again, thank you guys so much for joining. If you can, leave a rating or review, hit me up on some feedback. I'm available by email, and I'll keep that in the description. But until next time, I'll see you guys. Be blessed.